Good morning. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For the next hour, we'll be talking about one of America's most influential and celebrated writers, Samuel Langhorne Clemens, better known as Mark Twain, whose autobiography was kept under wraps for 100 years after his death. Volume 1, weighing in at more than 700 pages, was published just this year, containing Twain's recollections of his childhood, his family and friends, and some uncensored and highly critical views of some of the top political and business leaders at the turn of the last century. Twain was unorthodox in his approach to his life story. He dictated nearly 2,000 pages to his stenographer, remembering people, places, and events in a stream of consciousness style that makes you feel like the author is speaking to you in your living room. It was Twain's idea to only release the material 100 years after his death. Our guest for the next hour is the principal editor of the Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1, Harriet Eleanor Smith, the editor of the Mark Twain Papers and Project at the University of California at Berkeley. Maybe you're one of the lucky ones to get a copy of this book before it's sold out in bookstores all across the country. If you've had a chance to read it over the Christmas holiday, or maybe if you're simply interested in what Mark Twain had to say, we invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Harriet Eleanor Smith, thanks so much for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
How big of a project was this for you? And we know his biographers and editors had 100 years, but how long have you had to work intensively on this one volume?
Well, I actually started about 6 years ago. It was a huge challenge because up until that point, we actually thought that the book wasn't completed. Mark Twain left a miscellany of material. We didn't quite know how to put it together because he had this 100-year embargo. He hadn't actually prepared it for publication. But in the process of working with the materials, the picture became clearer. We still had our job set out for us because he left multiple versions of much of the material, which was dictated, and we had to collate or compare all the texts, figure out which version he wanted, how to interpret his revisions on the various versions. And also we discovered that he had gone through his early pieces, what we call his false starts or early experiments that he had written between 1876 and 1906 when he started the final dictations, and selected some of them to represent his earlier attempts. And he wrote little prefaces for those, which we then learned where to insert. So we were able to put together a final work.
What was the reason for keeping the autobiography under wraps for 100 years?
Well, he had his reasons, of course. he really wanted the opportunity to speak his mind freely. He said, for example, words of mine which can wound the living must wait until later editions. This book is not a revenge record. He was actually rather soft-hearted. He was very good at invective, at expressing his negative opinions of his associates, but he actually didn't want to hurt people's feelings. And when he expressed his views on religion and politics, for example, he didn't want to be ostracized or shunned, and he knew that his views, particularly on the established Christian church, would be very controversial and offensive to many people, and he didn't really want to deal with the consequences. He also spoke openly against the foreign policy of the U.S. at that time. We were fighting a war in the Philippines.
That was Theodore Roosevelt's foreign policy.
Yes, exactly. And after the Spanish-American War, the United States essentially bought the Philippines from Spain and stated that they planned to give the Filipinos their independence. But in reality, they didn't. They took over the country, and they fought the insurgents, as they were called, and took over. They wanted to have a foothold in that part of the world for commercial interests in the Far East. So he realized that the whole war had been fought on false pretexts, and he was horrified at the way that the U.S. Army was, in effect, massacring the indigenous peoples who were armed with crude weapons.
Go ahead. Well, he was very, very critical of that occupation, and specifically the military action in which 600 members of one of the Filipino tribes, the Moros, were killed. They were hiding in a volcanic crater, and our troops shot down from above, killing everybody, men, women, and children. And Twain, in the material that's in this volume, he called the American soldiers, these are his quotes, uniformed assassins and Christian butchers who left not even a child to cry for its dead mother. I mean, that's strong stuff 100 years ago.
Oh, yes. It's really quite horrifying. He's taking his information directly from the morning newspapers. He's quoting the New York Times and other papers and commenting on it, and is just horrified, of course, as anybody would be, at the way that the soldiers were not leaving a single enemy person alive, civilians included. And in this case, as you say, they were in effect trapped in a crater, fighting for their lives, and not a single one was left. There were 600 Moro people killed, and the U.S. suffered something like 15 casualties and only two or three deaths. It was not a fair fight.
And one of the things that Twain seems to, I don't want to use the word obsess, but it's something that he was obviously upset about, were people who portrayed themselves as Christians, as moral people, and yet people who could justify things like the slaughter of 600 innocents or justify some of the things that Mark Twain saw going on in the American economy with wealthy people looking out basically for themselves and not doing enough to help the overall economic system and the disadvantaged.
Yes, that's very true. He had a lot of criticism of what he considered the established church, the way that the church used what he considered false piety to defend their actions, whether they be in colonializing foreign countries, taking over for economic reasons and pretending or stating that their real mission was to bring Christian values to the benighted people in foreign lands. So he had it in for missionaries. He felt that they were, for the most part, hypocritical. He acknowledged, of course, that there were some that were doing good works, but for the most part, he saw them as simply another arm of the aggressive United States foreign policy. And likewise, domestically, he criticized the Rockefellers, for example,
yeah,
who preached in Sunday school the benefits of helping the poor and explaining that the rich man can't make it into heaven and so forth, while at the same time feeling that, well, in their case, it didn't apply because they were good people and therefore they didn't need to give their money away. I mean, that's putting it very crudely, but
yeah, it was young John D. Rockefeller,
Junior, yeah,
who taught Bible classes, and I did pull out a quote from the book. This is Mark Twain talking about young John D. Rockefeller and his interpretation of Christianity. This is a quote from Mark Twain. Quote, he stands up with admirable solemnity and confidence and discusses the Bible with the inspiration and confidence of an idiot. And then he said about John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s interpretation of what Jesus meant when he told the wealthy to give all their money to the poor. Another quote from Mark Twain, young John's father's millions and his own were a mere incident in their lives and not in any way an obstruction in their pursuit of salvation. Therefore, Christ's admonition could have no application to them.
Exactly. Yes. Put it much, much better than I ever could.
But he was associating with these people. You know, he knew John D. Rockefeller Jr.
He spent time with him. Yes.
And he knew Theodore Roosevelt. And he was very critical of Theodore Roosevelt, acted like he was a puffed up showman. At least that's the interpretation I got from it.
That's absolutely
impulsive,
right.
I mean, is what he called him.
He enjoyed Roosevelt's company. He was a good dinner companion, conversationalist. But Mark Twain saw him as flighty, constantly changing his opinion with no fixed purpose. But also, he was kind of a blusterer, somebody who was a showman, as you say. He wanted attention, and that really irritated Mark Twain. He just felt that he wasn't a man of serious purpose with a deeper understanding of what was going on.
And a lot of us who look back at Theodore Roosevelt now and look at him as being a very progressive politician and look at Mark Twain as being sort of a progressive author and humorist and somebody who was an observer on the American condition, you would think that Twain would have a higher opinion of Theodore Roosevelt. But, you know, that book was very that volume one of the autobiography is striking in that regard.
Yes. Well, he doesn't comment much on Roosevelt's domestic policy, which is where I think he was seen as a little more progressive. He focused very much on the war of aggression, the foreign policy, and that he simply abhorred.
He had some very dark views of the human condition. And if I can again read another quote here to sort of set the table for the conversation. Man, Twain writes, was not made for any useful purpose for the reason that he hasn't served any, that he was most likely not even made intentionally, and that his working himself up out of the oyster bed to his present position was probably a matter of surprise and regret to the Creator. Of all creatures that were made, man, he continues writing, is the most detestable. Of the entire brood, he is the only one that possesses malice. That one thing puts him below the rats, the grubs, and the trichnia. He is the only creature that inflicts pain for sport, knowing it to be pain. Again, comments from a man 100 years ago when those sorts of comments would have been considered blasphemous.
Absolutely. I can't really improve on that. That pretty much sums it up. He really had a very, very dim view of mankind. He didn't exclude himself from that category. He realized that he, too, was a member of the human race, and, of course, he didn't see all of those qualities in himself. But he saw animals. He actually loved cats. I mean, he said at one point that if the cat were crossed with a man, it would degrade the cat and improve man. He just really had an extremely cynical view of man's motives, his greed, and his cruelty.
But he was a complex individual too, wasn't he? If you read the book, you can't help but feel in touch with the emotional attachment that he had to his family, to his wife, to his daughter Susie. I mean, those things really were prime motivating factors for Mark Twain.
Yes, people often talk about how he became bitter in his old age, and I frankly don't quite see it that way. He was grief-stricken. He had lost what is considered his favorite daughter, Susie, to meningitis at age 24 in 1896. He lost his beloved wife after a long and painful struggle with heart disease. And he had lost an infant son many years earlier, so he suffered a lot of very severe losses in his life, and he did have this extremely cynical view, very dim view of the character of man. It was one of his favorite topics in writing his sort of homespun philosophy. But I don't see him as bitter. He was still full of the ability to enjoy life and full of humor, full of spirit, And as you say, he writes very, very movingly about his family and with great nostalgia, pleasant nostalgia, about the home life during the 1880s when things were still happy.
Well, dwelled on the cynicism of Mark Twain and the negative opinions that he's had of some of the top political and leaders during the turn of the last century. When we come back from this short break, let's talk a little bit about his human side and about those memories that he had growing up in Hannibal, Missouri. We're talking to Harriet Eleanor Smith. She is the principal editor of the Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1, weighing in at more than 700 pages. I'm Glenn Moberg, in for Kathleen Dunn. Maybe you got the book for Christmas. Maybe you got some questions about Mark Twain, Samuel Langhorne Clemens, and what made him tick. If so, we've got the right guest on for you. We invite you to join the conversation. In fact, we have wide open phone lines right now, so if you call right now, you can get in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Glenn Moberg, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Glenn Moberg, in for Kathleen Dunn on a Tuesday morning. Our special guest today, Harriet Eleanor Smith. She is the principal editor of the Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1. Harriet, this book is really a spoken volume. It was dictated to a stenographer. As we said at the beginning of the show, he dictated over 2,000 pages. And I felt that it gives you real insight into Twain's mind, insight that you might not get in a more formal, traditional autobiography.
Yes, I agree completely, because he follows what he calls his systemless system of meandering from one topic to another, jumping from one to another as his interest changes. He often gets up in the morning, picks up the newspaper, and just starts a riff on his reaction to what he's reading. And it's like a window into his mind. Sometimes he wanders onto topics that perhaps a little less interesting to us today, but sometimes he's reminiscing about his boyhood, and it's just amazing, his facility with language, the way that the words flow from his mouth naturally, as if he had revised it and worked it over and made it into a real, literary work.
That is what is amazing, because yes, it is so eloquent, and to think that he's doing this all in one take.
Absolutely.
Spontaneously.
We have some revisions on some of the typescripts. He did go over them. He made a few changes here and there, but mostly he was just changing a word, adding some commas, that sort of thing. He really didn't, in most cases, do extensive revisions. So what you read is pretty much what came out of his mouth. And it is remarkable that so often you just hear his voice, that special turn of phrase that's so uniquely his, comes through, even when he's talking about something that's just popped into his mind at the moment. He's off and running, and there he is in his real voice.
Mark Twain was much in demand as a speaker, and what I didn't realize until I read the book is how hard he worked to entertain an audience and make them laugh. You've got verbatim drafts of some of his speeches, and they're very funny. They're full of one-liners and long stories with punchlines. I got the feeling that if he were alive today doing the same thing, we'd have labeled him as a stand-up comedian.
Yes, I think many comedians actually feel that he was sort of the first. I mean, there were other humorists of his era that preceded him, but they tended to rely on other things like use of dialect or other things. And he really had that gift of storytelling. But as you say, he excelled as an after-dinner speaker. Late in his life, he wasn't doing much, in fact, any speaking for fees. He pretty much gave that up in the late, with his Round the World tour in 95, 96, when he needed to make money to pay off his creditors after he went bankrupt. And subsequent to that, he would lecture for charity, or he would give speeches after dinner. And of course, in those days, I guess people had longer attention spans. So after a banquet, people would stand up and make these long speeches, and it would go on for hours and hours. And he was amazingly entertaining. There's a speech printed in the book that you've probably seen, the speech that he gave on the occasion of a banquet given for his 70th birthday at Delmonico.
Yeah.
And you can get an idea of how entertaining he really was. But he could move his audience in other ways, not just to laughter, but also sentimentally as well. I mean, he had them in the palm of his hand, as we say. And it would have been remarkable to hear him. I know we have Hal Holbrook in our day, but I don't think that gives us really quite the right idea of what it was actually like to hear him make a speech, because, of course, Holbrook takes materials from here and there and puts them together into his own presentation. And I'm sure
I got I got
the
feeling
that there's a lot of Mark Twain in that, but it's not quite the same thing.
Hal Holbrook was kind of a safe version of Mark Twain, or at least that's the feeling I always got watching his presentations. Twain, Samuel Clemens, was always on the edge. You never knew what he was going to say next.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I've also wondered about the style of speech. Most Mark Twain impersonators tend to speak very, very rapidly, which is kind of the style of comedians today. But everyone says that Mark Twain's style of speech was drawling and slow and drawn out. And I don't think we have a good example of what that was really like. I'm not sure that that would work today with what people are used to. But I've always been curious to hear exactly what he sounded like. And we don't have a single recording that has survived, unfortunately. He made
what a shame.
Wax cylinders for Edison, but they were burned up in a fire.
What an absolute shame that we don't have a recording of his
Isn't
voice.
We have a 5-minute video, a motion picture of him walking around, but what we really, really want to have is a recording of his voice. It would be wonderful.
Harriet Eleanor Smith, she is the principal editor of the Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1. Let's go to the phones. Taylor in Rushford, Minnesota. You're on with Harriet Eleanor Smith. Hello, Taylor.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick comment when you were talking about his criticisms of the foreign policy of the time. I just wanted to say, isn't it, it's kind of neat that even 100 years ago, someone thought that the United States foreign policy was a joke, as is it is now, and I kind of wish that he would have spoke out more against it back then and publicly, and maybe had a chance to change it so it wouldn't have been as corrupt and as big of a joke as it is now. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks.
All right, Taylor, thanks so much for the phone call. Harriet?
Actually, he did speak out publicly on that subject. He wrote, for example, a piece called King Leopold's Soliloquy, which was published by the Congo Reform Society against King Leopold's persecution of the people in the Congo. He enslaved them, basically. He punished the natives for not cooperating as laborers by massacring them, mutilating them. It was just a horrible thing. And he did speak out against that, and he did write a number of pieces. There was one called To the Person Sitting in Darkness, which is a very satirical piece aimed at addressing non-Christians in foreign countries and explaining to them how the United States was going to bring them all the benefits of civilization, and, of course, pinpointing the irony of the fact that the so-called Christian values they were exporting were not, in fact, Christian at all in terms of the real meaning of Christianity.
That's a recurring theme with him.
And he was not silent about that.
1-800-642-1234 if you want to talk to Harriet Eleanor Smith, the author of The Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1. Let's go to Mike in Milwaukee. Mike, you're on with Harriet Eleanor Smith.
Yeah. What he had to say, according to you, about religion and about big government, military killing many people, like in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and all that, it seems so contemporary. It seems like it's happening now. So I would like to say that this is Mark Twain. He's talking to us from the grave, and he's given us a warning that this is what's happening. The rich are taking over the politics of the day, and I just think it's a message from the grave.
Well, it certainly seems that these topics are relevant today. Unfortunately, it seems that in many ways things have not changed. He did his best, and it's always good to have this voice speaking against the established policies.
We have a similar comment from Dave in Menominee on email. He says Twain's criticisms of politicians, greed, and the church could be made today. What do you, Harriet, think is the best comment from the past that still rings true today? And that's got to be a terrible question for you to answer after having pored over all of the many things that Mr. Twain said during his lifetime.
Well, it it is difficult to answer that. And, of course, I don't like to try to paraphrase him, although I'm often forced to do that when I don't have the book in front of me. I think that his comments, for example, about Jay Gould, is very familiar today when we think about the banking scandals. And
I've got those comments in front of me about financier Jay Gould. Here's the quote.
Yeah, I'm just looking for that. I think I've got the page. It says,
"The mightiest
Jay Gould has just been reversed the commercial morals of the United States."
That's it.
Go ahead if you have it.
"The mightiest disaster which has ever befallen this country. The people had desired money before his day, but he taught them to fall down and worship it."
Yeah. Yes, exactly. He taught the entire nation to make a god of the money and the man, no matter how the money might have been acquired. Then he goes on to say, "In my youth, there was nothing resembling a worship of money or of its possessor in our region. And in our region, no well-to-do man was ever charged with having acquired his money by shady methods."
We had an email from Susan in Fox Lake. And Mike, thanks so much for the phone call. She couldn't stay on the line, but she wondered about Twain's view on the government's treatment of Indians, especially after Little Bighorn.
Well, I'm sorry to say that that's probably one of the areas in which he was not as enlightened as he might have been. I think that there were two areas in which he had some prejudice. One was American Indians, and the other was the French, whom he really didn't like.
Well, that makes him contemporary as well, doesn't it?
I suppose. He did, however, have some perspective on the Indian issue. He writes in this volume about Thanksgiving, that it was a holiday established by the people of New England to celebrate the fact that another year had gone by during which that they had succeeded in exterminating the Indians instead of being exterminated by them. He does have a basic understanding of how the Indians were mistreated, but he doesn't have any really eloquent or extensive writings about the persecution of the Indians.
Well, let me expand a little bit on the Thanksgiving Day quote. He adds to it, "As time and the years drifted on, it was perceived that the exterminating had ceased to be mutual and was all on the white man's side, consequently on the Lord's side. The original reason for a Thanksgiving Day had long ago ceased to exist, the Indians having long ago been comprehensively and satisfactorily exterminated, and the account closed with heaven, with thanks due."
Mm-hmm.
Once again, powerful stuff.
Yes, and once again, his indictment of the use of Christian values, Christian piety, to justify mistreatment of others.
One of our listeners on email is also curious about whether he had a relationship with Jack London.
No, not that I'm aware of. I may be wrong about that, but I'm not aware of any correspondence.
Yeah, they were both contemporary authors, but I didn't see anything on him in that volume.
No, there's definitely nothing in this volume or in the autobiography. And as I say, I worked with the correspondence for many years, and I don't believe we have any.
And we have another caller who wants to know about Twain's view of racial issues. And he was very active with Booker T. Washington's Tuskegee Institute, was he not?
Yes, that's in this volume. He gives a speech here that's recounted in the New York Times, and the speech is reprinted here, speaking on behalf of the Tuskegee Institute and in favor of Booker T. Washington. He, of course, it's a long story, and I won't go on too long, but he did belong to a family that owned slaves. And he talks about how in his childhood he really was so naive and innocent, he didn't fully realize what an abomination slavery was. But as he grew older, of course, he realized that how wrong it was. We're all familiar with Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which is one of the most powerful indictments of prejudice, despite the fact that it's sometimes misread. But He married a woman whose father was an abolitionist and, in fact, was a stop on what they called the Underground Railroad. He had helped Frederick Douglass escape from slavery, and he absolutely was anti-racist, and all of his writings do reflect that.
About the Tuskegee Institute, let's see if I've got this. Here it is. He writes, no two groups of people can live side by side where one is in ignorance and poverty without its condition affecting the other. The black man must be lifted or the white man will be injured in his moral and spiritual life. And again, this was in what, 1906 that he was writing that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Way ahead of his time.
Yes.
Let's go back to the phones. Linda in Milwaukee, you are on with Harriet Eleanor Smith.
Okay, I have a vague memory from many, many years ago about a talk that Twain had done for a roast, and he was terribly ostracized for it in his personal life and shocked the people at this roast. And I'm pretty sure it was a very prominent person, but I don't really recall any details. Would you know more about that?
Yeah, I believe you're referring to the speech he gave at the 70th birthday dinner for Whittier, John Greenleaf Whittier. It's in this volume, actually, the whole speech and his opinions about it, and there's quite a bit of annotation in the back of the book that explains the circumstances. He gave a speech at the birthday party, I think it was 1877, and it's a little parody. He pretends that the three great poets of the day, Emerson, Longfellow, and Whittier, were knocking on a miner's cabin in the mountains and so forth. And he was told by his friend Howells, who was there, that he'd made a terrible, terrible mistake, and he deeply offended everyone. But in reality, it didn't quite happen that way. Apparently, at the dinner, some people had trouble hearing what he was saying, and there wasn't much of a reaction. He didn't get big laughs that he expected. But he actually wrote letters afterwards to the people in question and learned that they weren't offended. They were amused. It's just that it was so radical in its day, this kind of roasting, that he felt for years that he had made a terrible faux pas. And in the end, in this volume, he comes around to saying, you know, the speech really was funny. I really think it was funny. And he includes the whole thing here for us to read.
We are talking with Harriet Eleanor Smith, the editor of the Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1. Our lines are full right now, but if you'd like to join the conversation when we take the next call, 1-800-642-1234. We're going to take a short break. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kathleen Dunn on this Tuesday morning with the principal editor of the Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1, Harriet Eleanor Smith. 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to join the conversation. We now have three phone lines open up. Let's go to Paul in Duluth with a question for Harriet Eleanor Smith. Hello, Paul.
Good morning. My question is, I remember, I guess I was in like junior high school, and I had already read Huckleberry Finn, and I came across Jonathan Swift and Gulliver's Travels, and I'm wondering if there's it turned me into kind of a misanthrope in a lot of ways, those two books, and I'm wondering if Mark Twain had been influenced in any way by Jonathan Swift. I'm just kind of curious, and I'll listen off the air.
All right, thanks so much, Paul.
Well, that's a question I'd probably have to look up. I don't offhand know. I'm pretty sure he was extremely widely read. He probably had read Swift, but I don't know of any comments that he made about it. Certainly the the broad irony that Swift used in not only Gulliver's Travels, but in A Modest Proposal, is very similar to the kind of irony that Clemens himself employed in his political writings. So I think we can see they were both very gifted satirists, and they did have that in common.
I want to talk, Harriet, a little bit about his family, because we just touched on that. His wife, Olivia, died after 34 years of marriage, and we have been dwelling on these kind of inflammatory quotes because they're the ones that, seem to get all the attention. But here's what he said about his wife. Quote, "She was always frail in body, and she lived upon her spirit, whose hopefulness and courage were indestructible. Perfect truth, perfect honesty, perfect candor were qualities of her character which were born with her. She had the heart-free laugh of a girl. It came seldom, but when it broke upon the ear, it was as inspiring as music."
Yes, he also says that he himself didn't laugh easily and that she could make him laugh. There's a wonderful incident that I'm sure you've read in this volume where he is putting on shirts in the morning and getting very angry because one after another they're missing buttons and he's throwing them out the window and he starts cursing, which he is very good at. And when he walks back into the bedroom, he realizes that his wife has been overhearing him. And he just stops dead because she stares at him and then repeats back to him exactly the words that he's been using. And the words coming out of her mouth, so unpracticed, so incongruous, he just starts to laugh, and she starts to laugh, and the two of them just get hysterical. It's so charming to me to see how she dealt with him and how she did have a sense of humor. They did have a wonderful rapport.
And she watched out for him and kept him in line, kept him from embarrassing himself sometimes at his public appearances.
Dusting off Papa, as they called it, where she would instruct him on how to treat guests, how to behave himself when they were hosting parties and so forth, and had this system where they'd hold up, they'd mention different colored cards that would instruct him about what to do when he's talking too much to the woman on his right and was supposed to talk to the woman on his left, this sort of thing. And the children just took a delight in watching this happen. They enjoyed watching their mother berate in a gentle, loving way him for his faux pas.
Now, the death of his daughter, Susie Clemens, in her 20s from meningitis, had to be one of the darkest moments of his life. And he includes long passages of Susie's biography of him interspersed with his own remembrances. That almost seems to drive the narrative in much of the book.
Yes, it's a very interesting device. She started writing this biography when she was 14, I believe, in 1885. I may have the year wrong one way or the other. But anyway, and he, in fact, might have taken the inspiration for dictating his autobiography from the fact that while she was writing his biography, he would sort of perform for it, sit and speak, because he knew that his biographer was present. And it was that year that he first experimented with dictating the autobiography. He put that attempt aside, but it did plant the idea in his mind of speaking his story. Yes, it was an extremely tragic event, in part because he and his wife and other daughter, Clara, had been traveling around the world on a lecture tour. They hadn't seen Susie for a year, and she was back in Hartford, and she fell ill. When the family reached London, they received a telegram that she was ill, but probably would recover. So Olivia and Clara got on the boat to go back to the U.S. to nurse Susie. And while they were in mid-ocean, Mark Twain in London received another telegram saying that Susie had passed away. So here he's dealing with this just, as he puts it, it's amazing that a man can receive a shock like that and still survive. And knowing that his wife and daughter wouldn't find the news out until they actually landed in New York. You can imagine an era when they didn't have instant communication. And the agony that must have been.
And the recurring talk of childhood diseases, and this really illustrates a lot of what life was like in Hannibal, Missouri, when he was growing up there. Children coming down with scarlet fever, typhoid fever, and measles, many of them dying prematurely. Yeah. He writes about slipping into his friend Will Bowen's, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly,
bed.
Bowen, when he was sick with measles so that he wouldn't be the only one in town without the disease. And young Samuel Clemens came down with measles and almost died in the process.
Yeah, it's an interesting account. It's a recurring theme where he talks about, he has kind of a death wish in a way. He was so ill that he thought he was going to die.
And he said it was the happiest moment of his life.
Yes. It's as I say, he's a remarkable person, and it's sometimes hard to explain this.
And that question about the meaning of existence and life is also something that he raises over and over again. What are we here for? Why are we even alive? What's the purpose of all this?
Yes, and he, of course, quotes Susie on that, who raises the question of, you know, what's it all for? When she's still very young, she's already pondering these deep questions.
He had another friend, Tom Nash, a boyhood friend, and they went skating with young Sam Clemens on the Mississippi, and the ice starts breaking up. They were a half mile out, and Sam makes it back. Young Mark Twain makes it back unscathed. But his friend Tom falls into the river, gets scarlet fever, and it leaves him deaf. And you read these accounts, and you realize what a different world that was before we had the kind of medical care that we've got today.
Yes, of course, and as I mentioned earlier, he did lose a son at before he was 2 years old to diphtheria. Now we have shots for this sort of thing, but life was very precarious in those days.
Huckleberry Finn was based on another childhood friend of his, a guy named Tom Blankenship, who he writes was the son of the town drunk, and here's a quote. He was ignorant, unwashed, insufficiently fed, but he had as good a heart as ever any boy had. His liberties were totally unrestricted. He was the only really independent person, boy or man, in the community.
Yes, you can see how this gave him the seed of the idea for Huckleberry Finn, who, as you know from the novel, the main moral point is Huck's goodness of heart and his realization that he has to be a friend and have loyalty to Jim, the slave, despite the fact that society has taught him that it's wrong to help a slave escape from slavery.
And Mark Twain started smoking at an early age?
Yes, I believe he smoked corncob pipe for many years, and eventually, of course, the famous cigars that he smoked in huge quantities. It's sort of appalling to imagine what he smelled like and what the home smelled like with all these cigars, but I guess his wife was used to it.
Started smoking at the age of nine.
Yeah, well, in those days, I suppose, they didn't know as much about tobacco as we know now. And he did ultimately die of heart disease. It's not unlikely that the smoking had some effect ultimately on his health.
We're talking to Harriet Eleanor Smith. She is the editor of the autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1. And we're going to go back to the phones. Let's go to Beverly in Delavan. Beverly, you're on with Harriet Eleanor Smith. Hello, Beverly.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. It when we were talking about Mark Twain and his slow manner of speech, and the only person I can think of who would be close to that today would be Garrison Keillor with his storytelling. And then the question I have, and I'll hang up and I'll take that off the air, is, was there anyone who he really, really greatly respected who was in the political arena?
Harriet?
Oh, that's a good question. Nothing pops into my mind. I mean, there were people that he voted for, but I can't run through his politics for you, I'm afraid, off the top of my head.
Well, he did vote for Grover Cleveland.
Yeah, Cleveland is the only one I can think of. But
who was a Democrat in a very Republican era, and this, of course, is when the Republicans were progressives. And he
he was a mugwump, as they called him, voting out of his party, because he didn't approve of the of his Republican candidate Blaine.
James G. Blaine. He thought the Republican candidate was corrupt. He voted for Cleveland. He got some of his friends to vote for him, and they all suffered repercussions in terms of the good people of the day thought that he was committing heresy.
Yes.
But that kind of surprised me that he had such a positive impression of Grover Cleveland, a president that we don't think about very much anymore.
Well, that's why I actually didn't mention him first off, because I think it was a case of the lesser of two evils. I don't think he was really that enthusiastic about Cleveland, but he very much was against Blaine.
Let's go back to the phones. Isaac in Wapaka, you're on with Harriet Eleanor Smith. Hello, Isaac.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking the call. I was wondering if the book elaborated at all with Mark Twain's relationship to the inventor Nikola Tesla, and I guess I'll take my answer off the air.
There's a mention of one of Tesla's inventions when Mark Twain is talking about the Page typesetting machine and his investments in it and what a genius inventor Page was. And Page experimented with electricity, alternating current, direct current. I'm really not much of a scientist, but Tesla's invention is mentioned there, but nothing more extensive than that in this volume.
He was very critical of his publisher, Hartford Bliss of the American Publishing Company, and I'm laughing because I've got a quote here that is just...
Oh, good, yes.
Here it is. Here's Mark Twain describing his publisher, Hartford Bliss. Quote, he was a tall, lean, skinny, yellow, bald-headed, rat-eyed professional liar and scoundrel.
Yes, he felt that Bliss had cheated him on a whole number of books. I think at one point he says if Bliss told the truth about something, it was the first time in his life he had done it. Bliss's son took over the publishing company, and Clemens had more respect for him and did stay with the company for many, many years. But I was just thinking here, I've got a quote about his attorney that he mentions. He calls him a great, fat, good-natured, kind-hearted, chicken-livered slave with no more pride than a tramp, no more sand than a rabbit, no more moral sense than a wax figure, and no more sex than a tapeworm. So I'd say he was very creative when it came to it. This was the sort of thing he really didn't want to speak out in the open.
And you can see why he waited 100 years to have this published.
Exactly,
Now, in 1906, he supported the cause of Russian revolutionaries who wanted to overthrow the Tsar, and he even lent his name to a fundraiser to give the revolutionaries arms. And he writes, again, this is a quote from Mark Twain, some of us, even the white-headed, may live to see the blessed day when czars and grand dukes will be as scarce in Russia as they are in heaven. This, of course, was before the communist revolution, which came, 11 years later.
Yes, well, this was, of course, a revolution against the czarist monarchy, and he was particularly incensed, again, by the massacre of the Jews that was going on at the time, and that the czars were carrying out, the pogroms, and he talks about that at length also, gets into it in Volume 2, and he was very much in favor of overthrowing that regime.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Joe in Lac du Flambeau with Harriet Eleanor Smith. Hello, Joe.
Hi. I'm wondering if, did Twain know Ambrose Bierce at all? And it seems like his writing is kind of in the same vein a lot of times, especially I'm wondering if he had any comments about Bierce's work, The Devil's Dictionary.
Yes, he did know Ambrose Bierce. There was some question about when they actually met, because he claims he met Bierce in San Francisco, but my research indicated they actually weren't there at the same time. But he definitely had some association with Bierce when he was in England in the early 1870s. I don't have knowledge of any extensive comments about his work, but he did appreciate him as a satirist and a humorist, and did feel a certain kinship with him.
Harriet Eleanor Smith, why should we care about what this man, Mark Twain, Samuel Langhorne Clemens, what he said more than 100 years ago? Why is it significant to us today?
Well, I think some of your callers have made the point that his comments about politics and religion seem very, very relevant today. They are timeless in that sense. But also, as a human being, his expressions of his emotions, his incredible facility with the language to express universal experiences, rings true today. And I think that people are fascinated with him not only as an author, but as a character, as a human being whose life continues to fascinate us.
Harriet Eleanor Smith, thanks so much for being with us today. Harriet Eleanor Smith, the principal editor of the Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1, the Mark Twain Papers and Project, University of California at Berkeley. And I can't wait to see Volume 2. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kathleen Dunn this morning. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Erica Janik and Dave Potras for on-air production. If you want a copy of the show, we can send you a CD. You can ask for show number 1228E. That's 1228E. Larry Mueller is up next. Until next time, take care, and thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.